Okay, welcome back to the third panel of the day. And thank you very much for the music. That was very inspiring. It's great to see that people are taking that spirit of DIY and getting involved with issues that need to be tackled. We have an amazing and eclectic lineup for this. Kitty Calf, some of you have met already today. We have Fergie McGanna, who really doesn't need an introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway. In addition to being an amazing educator and a great writer, and if you really want to know what that scene was like, Fergie's autobiographies are a great document of what it was like in Dublin at that moment. And we have Bernie Furlong, probably better known from the Golden Horde, but you know, an activist in our own right as well. And Suzanne Ratigan, who was in a number of bands here and then had a really interesting career in London and New York and beyond. So I just thought that to get a sense, because the last panel, I think, brought home the fact that these people were young, dynamic, creative, and there wasn't an audience for rock music. There certainly wasn't an audience for punk music in Dublin in 1976 and 1977. You had to go, it was hand-to-hand combat. Bands came and they either got threatened or, you know, as happened with the Radiators, they were told by the types of people who were experts in who was allowed to play, was, you know, go away and learn to play your instrument, come back in 5 years. So these people were pioneers. So I'd just love to get a sense of, before you became performers, did music matter to you? Were you listening? Were you fans? Suzanne, what were you listening to growing up in Dublin?
Well, you know, I'm not really honestly sure why I'm sitting here in amongst the luminaries of this era in terms of that kind of thing. I mean, I was coming more from stage school type stuff, so in that era I wasn't really in tune with that kind of punk scene at all. And it wasn't really till I kind of hooked up with Ed Dara, who was mentioned earlier in her band Toy With Rhythm, that I got involved in the music scene in Dublin, really. And I mean, they weren't a punk band, but I suppose they had a punk ethos about them,
and
it was all very indie, and you know, we had great crack and we did all that stuff, and it was great fun. But yeah, I mean, my first punk gig, and I wouldn't even describe it as a punk gig, was seeing the Boomtown Rats. I know that sounds terrible saying that out loud, in the Olympia on the day before I did my inter. So I was in the Olympia watching the Boomtown Rats the day before I was doing my English exam in the inter. So I was that age then, so I mean, I wasn't really connected with it at that point. So yeah, maybe there are others on the panel better.
No, but to me, that's not a terrible thing. Like, that's a great thing that there was a band from Dublin who sang their own songs, and it was the first time a band from Ireland singing their own songs went to number one in Britain.
Mm.
So to me, it's actually very, you know, whatever any of us think about the man, Geldof, and you know.
Mm. But I think there's a lot of bands
that
weren't necessarily
doors.
Punk bands.
Yeah.
Who kind of, as I think Philip and the others were, Pete was mentioning earlier, you know, they weren't really punk bands. They were just sort of labelled punk because they happened to be around at that time, you know, which is fine. But, you know, the Boomtown Rats were, I suppose they were more labelled a punk band than they were a punk band, in my memory of them anyway. So, I mean, I was in the third row at the Olympia that night, sort of wondering why I was being spat at and this kind of guy prancing around the stage. I didn't really get it at that point, yeah. I'm not sure I'm very qualified to really discuss that era properly.
I never saw Boomtown Rats ever, but I would really love to spat at Bob Geldof. I'll do it today.
I saw them playing in the Marquee in London. This was my first summer away from home, and I ran away to London to, because I'd already fallen in love with punk rock, and we saw every, like, I saw every band that was, you know, playing at the time. Didn't see the Pistols because they were banned by the GLC because it was 1977. But I remember my friends saying, we have to go and see this, this Irish punk band. I just remember feeling mortified and really embarrassed and sort of like, oh dear, please don't associate me with this, you know. So that was the only time I saw them. But
and who else did you go and see? You know, because I think it's really important to anyone in this room who wants to see their favourite band can probably wait and see them in Dublin. But in that era, bands didn't come to Ireland in the 70s up until 76 with that punk new wave, you know, as it became branded. So there's also a stream of immigration, you know, with four people here. You know,
sure.
You went to go and see the bands. So Bernie, who else did you go and see that you loved?
Well, this was the summer of 1977, and I suppose I just finished secondary school. And I saw the Slits. They were probably the most, you know, amazing band to witness, and obviously hugely kind of formative and influential. Like lesser known, but still amazing. Like bands like Penetration, Saw Susie. Pretty much anybody of that sort of wave, first wave of punk that was gigging at the time.
Fantastic.
That I saw in London during that summer, so it was amazing. Yeah.
And Freddie, you went at one stage, but what were you listening to as a young person growing up in Ireland? Like, what was inspiring to you?
But I was trying to avoid Genesis. Everybody I knew was
always
into Genesis. And I just thought, if that's the future of life, I just want out.
Yes.
So then Dr. Feelgood came along. And when Dr. Feelgood came along, I was in 74, 75, and I just thought everything made sense. The music I liked made sense. I liked short, guitar-driven songs. I did not like slow songs. I wanted to form a band that didn't play any slow songs. I thought that was a great ambition to have. And I saw the Boomtown Rats, and they didn't play many slow songs. It was kind of hard to remember, before they got their record deal, they blew away a lot of cobwebs. They played gigs, they were in people's face, they were very like the Rats. It was called high energy music. Steve was absolutely right. I remember that time when you were billed as high energy music. So the music I was interested in was R&B, you know, rhythm and blues, rock and roll. I saw a band called the Fabulous Thunderbirds in London, and they all wore the coolest jackets I've ever seen in my life, and they played this really, really hard blues, and I just thought, that's fantastic music. To me, Little Richard was a punk, you know, and those people were groundbreaking, and I just loved the whole idea of it. And what happened for me was I got a job at the Dandelion Greenwood as a student selling punk rock badges, thanks to John Fisher, who I hope is here or will be here, because he put on the gigs in the Dandelion Green. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but it was a stage where, well, what I remember in particular was that the holes in the roof where the rain came in.
That was amazing,
the electricity,
yeah, the Dandelion gigs.
On the edge all the time, but it was great. It was a scene, and so I worked with a guy called George Sweeney, who was in the Vipers later on, and he was in the Max Quad band with Adam Clayton, and he was out of a band, and so we started coming up with names for bands, and because everyone, we're selling names like, you know, Penetration, 999, The Slits, all these wonderful bands. And we just thought to ourselves, well, why don't we come up with a name for a band, and then we'd have a band. So we came up with Rocky De Valera and the Gravediggers, and suddenly we were a band, and we rehearsed in a shed, and I sang into a broom handle because we didn't have any mics, and I think that probably did my voice in. And then, but 2 years later, I found out what tuning was, and that kind of thing. So we played a gig. In 1978, we played a gig. The scene itself was fantastic. And if you ask me what the difference was before, say, The Clash came to Trinity, and before Dr. Feelgood played, and before people started forming bands like The Threat, and I saw The Radiators from Space in Moran's Hotel, and they were wonderful. They were like being inside a jet engine. They were fantastic. But the difference was around 1977, it changed from black and white to color. It suddenly came into Technicolor. So everything became vivid and alive, and you suddenly met people who were part of a tribe. And I wasn't a pure punk, but because we were rock and roll, wore leather jackets, we went to Advance Records and bought the records. It was kind of high energy music was accepted. Reggae, high energy music, punk, it all kind of mixed in together, and it was great fun. That's my memory of it.
And Kitty, we heard a little bit, but not enough of your story in the earlier panel. Like, how did you get into music? What were you listening to before the Boy Scouts that inspired you?
I used to sing a lot. I used to really enjoy singing. I used to get out a lot of frustration, just belting out songs. I liked liked a lot of soul. I liked traditional music. I used to, all sorts. Hip-hop, Velvet Underground, just like really quite a broad range of stuff. And Rocky's obviously got impeccable taste, because he had us support his band. That was our first ever gig, wasn't it?
Hoth Community Centre. And we forgot to collect the money at the door afterwards, and the promoter kept it.
Someone stole my shoes, and I stopped halfway through the gig because I wanted a new gig. I got these crocodile kind of shoes in a second-hand shop, and they were my punky pride and joy. And while I was singing, I found it really uncomfortable standing in them, so I left them inside the stage. Next thing, they were gone. So I said, "Where's Pete's got my fucking shoes?"
Your house was always dangerous back then. If you had shoes, you laced them up when you were going there.
I remember my first pair of bondage pants. We were going off to London, and you had to have your punk gear. So I sat in a room for about 3 days, and I got some old curtains of my mother's, and cut out a design. And I was really useless at sewing, but I spent 3 days making these bondage pants. And I got the fabric, it was all flowery, and I dyed it. And I thought, then I had these bondage pants, and I thought I was so fucking cool, you know. I went to London, and it was a very hot, sunny summer. And I was wandering around in my bondage pants, thinking I was like so cool. And the sun was slowly bleaching the black out of my pants, so you could see the curtain fabric coming through, which I was like getting mortified. But actually, that was pretty punk, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Just because all of you had that experience of leaving Ireland, and Bernie, can I come back to you just for a moment? You were going as a young person to see gigs in London. This was pre-Ryanair, this was pre-Aer Lingus.
I got the amazing ferry. I think I had some kind of like glandular fever or something when I was going, and my mother was trying to convince me that I should not go, and it was like I was determined. I got in some kind of summer job working in a hotel just to finance my experience of going over to see punk bands, basically, because I'd been listening to John Peel all of the previous year, and it's like it was a dream. But it was fine. I mean, there was the same as anything else. It was probably as cheap as Ryanair to go by ferry, but it took a lot longer, and there's a lot more tiredness at the end of it. But you sort of did it because, well, there was no other alternative. But it was kind of a journey, and you actually, you know, you were traveling, you were going to a different place, so you very much felt you were in a different place when you got there.
And did you go with friends from Ireland, or did you just...
No, I mean, I knew some other people who were going, but they definitely weren't going for the same... Like, they were going because they wanted to earn money for college. And that was my pretend excuse, but I really just wanted to go and see the bands. And I was the only one who didn't save anything. Everyone else had saved up money for their, you know, for going to college, but...
But you got to see all the great bands.
Yeah. So no, I didn't. I made friends there, but I knew people there, and we all stayed in the same hostel to begin with. But I didn't have anybody that was the like-minded person whom I was going with. No, I just arrived and I just went, okay, here I am in the hostel. Okay, what do I do? So it was right about 7 o'clock at night. So I just said, go to the King's Road. So I went to the King's Road. Walked along it, looked in the windows, and looked in Boy and Seditionaries and stuff like that.
Stole a T-shirt.
Boy. Yeah. My cat's called Boy after that toy shop.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
Deadly.
Yeah. I got barred from Boy.
Why?
I don't know. I think. I won't say. I'm from London originally, so you know, like, I grew up in the '60s in London, and all the different sounds, like what inspired me is just I was living in Haringey, a really posh part of London, you know. I think it's got the title, The Most Likely Area to Get Stabbed in London in 2016. And you know, I loved it there. It was completely multiracial, and there was the sights and the sounds and the spells and the music and calypso. And then my parents decided to emigrate to Ireland. So as soon as I was physically able and old enough, I was straight on hitchhiking on over to back to London, and I went over in 75. There was a big, huge squatting scene there at the time, and I was in this lot of Irish, of course, going over, and a lot of squats full of Irish people as well. And I lived in a place called Prince of Wales Crescent. It was, the whole area was squatted. one of the songs, the Boy Scouts, I wrote the song 66, but it was about 66, Prince of Wales Crescent. But that's where I think I saw the first, sort of before punk, sort of pre-punk. It was a self-organized community. They had their own, it was a huge street. They had their own mental health unit. They had their own sort of police force. This was all community driven. It's quite, it was anarchy in action, really. And there was a place called a polytantric, and it was a squat, and they took out the whole basement was made as a venue. And I think that's where I first saw women performing in playing guitar, electric guitar and stuff. So that made a big impact. And then it was just coming back to Ireland and back and forward.
Tell me a bit more about that, because that's really interesting that you're involved in the squatting movement, which, had a political, and I think, that's why we didn't want to call this a punk event, punk and DIY, it allows you to open up a fact. And I don't think punk was gift wrapped in 1977 in Dublin. Like, it wasn't a thing that you were. It was often a thing that you could pick little bits from and, form your own identity from. But in that squat scene, and obviously there were other people from Ireland over there, I'm thinking of the band Prague Vec, who then Barbara Gogan then went on from Prague Vec to be in The Passions with that amazing song, I'm in love with a German film star. So there were Irish people over in those squats, and as you mentioned, people from Northern Ireland as well who were very liable to pick up just for their accents. But you saw women perform there, and that mattered to you.
It made a big impact.
And did that make you?
Wasn't a venue. It was a venue, but it was created by this whole community of people coming together, and it was quite impressive. I think Crass continued on that whole squatting. They were in a different part of London, but I think that was very important to the whole emergence of punk. And I remember we used to wear, everyone was going around in flares listening to Genesis and everything, but we used to wear straight jeans, and we thought we were like cool because we wore straight jeans, and this made us, significantly different to everyone who's wearing flares.
Great, and again, just I really want, and before people who are very qualified to speak about this, just to get the difference between Dublin's music scene at the time and London's music scene. Freddie, you were back and forth a little bit.
Yeah, I did the squats as well. I think I might have stayed in that place for a while in early 70s. But to me, it wasn't so much London, it was America. It was Blondie, the Ramones, it was Talking Heads, it was the No Way for the Blank Generation. That was the stuff that I really got to, especially the Ramones. I mean, those songs, the look that they had, that first album. And I remember the hatred that people had for that music, the Genesis fans as well as some of the other. I mean, that era was, I don't know how to describe it, it was kind of hippie fascist. It was kind of like, there was a certain amount of thing that you could approve of. And there's a song by Holly and the Italians about, about this girl hating another girl. She says, and to be a musician, she goes to school. The idea that, you couldn't just pick up a guitar and play. So the thing that changed for me was that it was suddenly became possible, if you wanted to be in a band, to be in a band. If you had something to say, you could say something. I remember a band called The Threat. I just remember every gig that they had was like, it wasn't a political event, it was simply a passionate statement about, every song was, they were saying something, and they were wonderful, they were a three-piece. And I don't know what happened to the singer, Morris, but I remember them being a huge influence for maybe...
He joined Hare Krishna's for a while, I'm not sure if he's still.
I hope he comes out of there and maybe he comes to the next one of these.
Stano,
the
right?
Stano is an...
And Deirdre, who Deirdre. Was in the Boy Scouts.
Boy Scouts, yeah,
she joined.
Right. So that, I mean, I love the fact that that you, when you went to one of those gigs, you didn't know what you were going to see. Something would kick off. And then there were a lot of really melodic bands that I thought were influenced by America, like Fabulous Fabrics and The Sinners, who had a reggae feel to them. So suddenly, I mean, I can't speak for the other places, but in Dublin, you had a variety. Whereas before, you had a uniform hippie culture. Suddenly, you had this music. I suppose you could call it roots. A lot of it was very heavy reggae, bass sounding music. And then the bands began to form. When we hear from Elvira later, but the Arc in Cork was like, it was like an academy. You played your gigs in the Arc in Cork. If you survived, the crowd were great, but I mean, they didn't put up with nonsense. So you needed to have your stuff together. to play there.
The Ark was like a pilgrimage for us. I remember, like, later in the 80s, then we'd go down to see Micro Disney and bands like that. And yeah, huge. More so than probably Dublin had a venue like that. You know, Cork was...
And also, being in the band gives you a chance to slag the authorities, you know? Gave you a chance to put the boot in and say what you thought. You know, up until then, music was about... Well, a lot of it was about something pie in the sky. But, I mean, Radiators from Space said what they wanted to say on their... You know, their songs became iconic in Ireland. I remember that we took the name De Valera for a reason, mainly because I couldn't really play an instrument, so I became the singer. So I thought, well, okay, well, I better get noticed somehow. So I called myself Rocky De Valera. And then we played a gig in Kerry, and there was a Fianna Fáil conference around the corner, and we were in the Abbey Inn in Tralee, and we were playing our songs, and then we noticed all these guys with rosettes and suits standing there watching us, trying to figure out, was I the bastard son of Eamon De Valera, who was now singing a new kind of political manifesto? So that was the kind of, I think a lot of it was about irreverence and, you know, breaking rules and coming up with all sorts of ideas, and the music was there as well, you know, so...
Anti-authoritarian.
That's what appealed to me.
Yes.
Like in the you're like living in the squats with like Rudy from Northern Ireland. I remember coming back from some gig, and they got pulled over, and we're in their van. We were coming from the music machine. They'd done a gig called Electric Gorn, and the cop asked him for his driver's license. And as soon as he heard the Northern Irish accent, we were all lying in the back and trying to hide. As soon as he heard the Northern Ireland accent, out, and then we all got taken out. We all got taken to. I mean, it was Rudy and the Boy Scouts. We all got taken into Nick, and we hadn't done anything. And then they strip searched us. And I remember the first time I ever got strip searched, I was really, really fucking angry because we hadn't done anything. The only crime was this guy with a Northern Irish accent that we were taken in. And I was saying, no, I'm not getting strips. I'm not taking my clothes off. And then she said, I'll get two other male policemen come in and hold you down while we do it. So I had to did it with real resentment and real anger, and the whole sort of looking around internally and everything, and really made us angry, you know. But I was, you know, you used to get attacked a lot, and a lot of women, you know, when you were punk, people would have a go at you.
I remember
you get beaten
being
up.
Buses in Dublin and just having bus drivers not letting you on and stuff, or going, or just basically, I suppose, attacking you verbally and abusing you verbally, and, you know, sort of sexually abusing you as well, and just calling you sluts, and, you know, because of the way, I mean, you know, it was considered to be quite provocative to wear, like, skinny black jeans, or,
But the second time we got strip searched, you know, because this used to be a regular thing, and... I always remember the cop walking in, standing at the door, being really feeling really angry. And then when he came in, it was just like his pair of knickers went flying through the air. They landed like close to him, and then I realised that my friend with me had taken all the clothes off. So after that, whenever we got arrested, we immediately, they wouldn't even have to say a thing, just start off with the clothes. What are you doing? You're going to strip search us, aren't you? Oh, no, keep your clothes on. No, we're going to get strip searched. Come on. Right, let's get on with it. So now that's my thing. Off the glaze immediately. And even a couple of years ago on Kevin Street, and they were going to let me out, and I could hear the cop coming. Then I'd taken off everything. They threw me in the cells, and I was fucking freezing. Put my clothes on. I could hear them coming quick as a light. Up off the glaze. The door opens. I walk out. All my clothes, and he just looks at me and he pushes me back in for another couple of hours.
Madness, but it was
the anti-authoritarian.
Yeah, and that's kind of a theme that's emerged from this particular conversation is, you know, that kind of mainstream culture. I'm reminded of one of the most shocking things I read about the Radiators when I was going through, you know, the old magazines. Starlight or Spotlight, it used to change its name, and it covered the show bands, but then it was trying to be kind of cool, so they put in Gary Glitter and some of those.
He's deadly, isn't he?
Yeah. They knew their audience there. But, you know, they were
Dickies.
Covering...
What about Dickies?
They were covering glam rock as well. And the music... I won't mention his name, but the music critic in New Spotlight, you know, said, oh, the Radiators from Space have given me their demo tape. what a joke, as if I would review anything that's punk in a music column. He was in the band that had a brilliant, a perfect name. He was in a band called The Establishment. And, you know, he's obviously living it, but, you know, you live, you know, and hats off to your capable, confident people who are able to talk about those potentially very humiliating things that were happening. Yeah. So, Suzanne, you told me an amazing story because you were in bands when you were extremely young and you were brought in as a singer. And the theme of this panel, as far as I'm concerned, are people who didn't stand for the type of compromise that a lot of other Irish people put up with at the time. And there was a great story about, you know, the payment for a gig, one of your early gigs with a band. Do you even remember the story?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'm not sure if that what story that is. I do remember the first time I was ever paid to sing, yeah. Because, you know, one of my first opportunities of singing in a studio was given to me by Deke O'Brien, who of course had Scoff Records, and a very eclectic label. And that was my first time meeting Fernia when I sang on a Rhythm Kings record, and I also sang on a Stano record. Now, I hadn't a clue who these people were because I really was young and very green. So I went from being a young girl, really, not really knowing anything, to being a session singer. So I'd come from playing a few bands, and all of a sudden I was in London singing on hit records. And then that went on for a number of years, but it started in Ireland with Deke and Scoff Records, and it just amazed me how many the range of bands and acts that then subsequently I would eventually work with, including bands like the Raincoats, who had been around in the early punk days, who I then eventually years later recorded as a producer in a different guise altogether. So I mean, it's amazing to me how, you know, the thing spirals around, etc., etc. But the Scoff thing was a big turning point for me. And it was my first experience of, I mean, they were really an indie label, I mean, along with so many. And the next indie label that I would have known was PWL. I mean, Pete Waterman, they were an indie label. And I worked with them at the time when they were having hit records. But it was like being in any indie label you could imagine. They loved their music. They believed in it. What fired them up and kept them going was their commitment to that. They were absolutely just like any other indie label, you know, which you'd never think if you heard their records, you know. So, but that story you're remembering is Shay Healy approached me one night. I was with Ed, in fact, in a nightclub on Leeson Street, and he wanted somebody to sing a song for him that he'd written. And he asked me if I'd come in the studio, and I said, yeah. And he said, I'll pay you. And I went, no, you don't have to pay me. And Ed shut up. So he gave me a check for 50 quid, which at the time was a fortune, which I never cashed. And I actually still have. So I'm not sure if the bank will honor it now. But yeah, so I think that must be the story you're remembering. But my experience was much more, and you know, of that end of things. After Toy with Rhythm, that was my, I briefly was with Les Enfants, a pop band from Dublin as well. But I wasn't in bands after that until I formed my own bands years later. So it was all the other side of things, studios and that side of things was my main experience.
Yeah, but those are early bands, and none of them sold huge quantities of records. None of them were particularly famous, but they gave you your first moment on stage.
Yeah.
And entrepreneurs like Deke O'Brien, we didn't have punk labels in 77 in Dublin. Obviously, Good Vibes was up in the north and was incredibly successful. There were lots of small DIY labels, but Dublin just never had that. It was a very, very small, we were backward in terms of the mainstream music industry. But Bernie, how did you start performing? You went from being someone going to see the Slits and Susie and the Banshees in England.
Yeah, I suppose how can I put this? I've always thought of myself as being somebody that I'm not happy to just to just consume. I like to, you know, create and produce. So I think I always had this thing in my head that I wanted to be producing the music that I was seeing. I mean, something similar, and just definitely from that kind of punk rock aesthetic sort of thing. But it didn't sort of really happen straight away. And I guess I didn't kind of go out pursuing it either. But I was going out with Des O'Byrne, who was in a band called The Letters, which was around 79, I think.
Fine thing he was, too.
There you go. Yeah, he was. So myself and Des, and we were living together, and I guess I was kind of, he was in the letters and he was in a band called the Juju Gooks, and I was kind of working away doing this thing of, you know, will we do something together musically? And then, I don't know exactly how it happened, but this other person, Simon Caramity, appeared, and he wanted people to get involved in a band he was trying to start, so we did. And that was it. But I always felt it was going to happen. It was just, but I didn't kind of push it. It had to sort of happen organically. It was almost like we were this little gang that were going to be a band together. And so that was kind of it.
Great. And what did that feel? I think it was like the second Golden Horde gig of them for Fall in McGonagall's.
Yeah, I don't know if that was the second or maybe the third. I know the first one was in the Hirschfield Centre, which was the it was like a gay kind of social LGBT social centre that had a club called Flickers, and I don't even know how we managed to wangle a gig. I mean, they did very little live gigs, but I'm not sure if it was at the same time, but I know say Paul Cook, a guy that we knew who was DJing there, and it may have been him that got us the gig, and there was like a horrendous number of people on stage. I can't even remember, like 13 or 14 people. And they sort of filtered away pretty fast. It was basically any friends of Simon's who wanted to get on stage got on stage, seemed to be. A few of us were actually doing something. Some of us were singing, some of us were playing. The second one I can't remember. We did play the Trinity Bowl pretty early as well, I know that. And then we played Supporting the Fall then, not long after. That was amazing. Again, just friends of ours were promoting, bringing over bands. And Caroline, and she was a friend of ours, had been in the Horde, then kind of left. And she was promoting, and she brought them over, and we supported them. That was amazing. It was great to play McGonagall's. I remember that we had a big fight on stage, but that wasn't unusual.
It only made it better. And Freddie, you loved those R&B high octane, the bands that were inspiring the Radiators as well. Were you messing when you got up on stage first, or did you think, you know, this is me? You know, did punk allow?
Well, I love punk, but kind of pre-punk. I was in a college band called Johnny Durex and the Punk Pistols, and we formed a gig, and then. The only way you could get into the band is if you couldn't play something. So if you couldn't play guitar, you plugged in, you had to get an amp. And so we had these people who couldn't play, and halfway through a gig, we had one rehearsal before going on stage, and one of our songs was called Fuck Bill Grundy. I don't know if you remember him, but that was about the only one that people remembered. But halfway through, somebody turned a hose on us and nearly fried everyone. So I thought that was an interesting introduction. And that was for the crack. That was just before we knew what punk was. When we got serious about it, myself and Dave Sweeney formed the Gravediggers. But I think McGonagall's, like, when you look back at McGonagall's with the carpet that seemed to move of its own.
And the dressing room that was also the kitchen.
Yeah. And there was when the hippies had it, there was a kind of a soya burger. Do you remember? That used to move as well. It was an amazing place, though, because I remember seeing the Outcast come down and play a gig there. And it was supposed to be a lunchtime gig on a Saturday. And there was a fight, and the fight was around where there was three brothers in the Outcasts, and there was a guy called Getty who played rhythm guitar. And once the fight hit one of their cousins, involved one of their cousins, the three brothers hopped off stage and beat up the audience. And the audience loved it. They got lots of encores. That was fantastic. So that was McGonagall's on a Saturday at lunchtime. So I think anything could happen. It was a different era, a totally different time. And the weird thing about it was that I think that there was an absence of authority and an absence of adults, you know, and adults in the awful sense, you know. There were no, I don't remember police being around those gigs very much. I don't remember anything happening with McGonagall's. I just remember McGonagall's being free fall. Like, it just went on forever. And there was a place called the Coffee Inn opposite McGonagall's where you could get pizzas that you could use to tile your roof if you wanted, you know, if you didn't meet them. But it was run by a guy called Joe, and everyone could just hang out there. So bands would meet there and you'd hear about gigs. I don't know if you had that experience.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I do remember going to the Coffee Inn, probably like pre-Horde, but yeah, definitely. It was one of those few places, and actually there were like very few bars that you'd get served in either.
Yeah.
I remember that, but I remember like the Bailey oddly did serve you, and then the Foggy Dew in the early iteration when it was just the tiny tiny room, and but very, very few.
People did get, I think that Paul Webb, was that the DJ?
Paul Webb
used to connect up people. I haven't seen Paul for a long time. He used to connect up people, and gigs would happen because he knew people who knew people who had a back room. I remember the Steering Wheel in Capel Street was a venue for a while.
Yeah.
And the cop cars used to pass by, and the amps would pick up the radios for the cop cars, so you'd find out what crimes were going on or while you were in the middle of the song. But gigs would stop up, like Barry's Hotel was a punk venue for about a month, and everyone played there. I can remember the ballrooms opened up, as Steve Rappel was saying, and they didn't know what to make of anybody who wasn't a show band. So it was, there were no applause, they were like, it was like a zombie gig, you know. And I remember we played a gig once there, and we didn't play the national anthem because we were, you know, a rock band, we didn't do that. And the dressing room got stormed, and we were in the dressing room, and they were trashing the stage, and they were trashing. This is the audience who'd been jumping up and down and loving it earlier. And then the bass player said, fuck this, and he went up and he got onto the stage and he just sang Sheena Fina Fall into the mic. And the audience heard that, went away, they sang it with them, we got up on stage and sang it with, everyone sang, and then the audience came and said it was the best gig they'd ever seen. And the weird thing was that the local skinheads apologised for the behaviour of the crowd afterwards. So it was an Ireland that was still evolving, you couldn't tell what was going to happen in the gig. So I know, it's a very different era now, and we're trying to think what's still left, like the Toners, McGonagall's, the Bag It In. I mean, the last great do-it-yourself gig that I remember was the Underground, where like it just seemed you didn't know what was going to happen next, bands just suddenly. And I imagine Fibbers is fantastic. I haven't been for a long time, but the scene was so out there, you know, it was so different. And the other thing I remember about that scene is that everyone wore a badge. You got your badges for your bands printed in Crazy Horse Corner, and you wore them, and then you gave them to people. And maybe it was the first networking merchandising way to do things.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. And obviously, you were that soldier. You were selling the badges, so you knew what bands people were into. Kitty, you have this dual identity because you've lived in England, you've lived in Ireland. You go back to England, the squatting scene is there, but then you come back here and you do something important, which is form a girl band in Ireland.
I didn't form the band.
Well, sorry. That you're part of the Boy Scouts, which were this girl band who weren't the nice show band singers that we've been used to. How did that feel to be on stage? And
well, you know, like you were saying earlier, how did you take it seriously? You know, like we've no recordings, but we thought we were going to take over the fucking world. You know, we really did. We thought what we were doing was really important, and we thought we were absolutely brilliant.
Yeehaw!
Yeah. Go kitty! Yeah. So, but I think that people, you know, it wasn't just fun. We thought we were doing something important at the time, didn't we? Yeah.
You were. I mean, I saw, you played in Hoth and you played, I saw another gig you played as well. Boy Scouts were brilliant, absolutely amazing, and it's a tragedy there's no recordings. There's a few demos, isn't there, in existence somewhere, and there's a bunch of songs that have never been recorded. So it's about time you made your album, I think.
No, and I do think it's very important that as much as the panelists are, you know, talking about this feeling that the adults weren't around, the reason the adults weren't around is because young people at that time, and I'm sitting beside some of them, were doing their own thing. Like, you weren't waiting for someone else to say, oh yeah, you're a good singer, or you've got the right look so you can be in the Eurovision.
You didn't have to be a good singer. Yeah. You didn't have to be good at anything. You just... Yeah, but it's like we're talking about different venues. I think the best ever punk rock thing that happened here was the Dark Space. Dark Space, was that 48 hours?
In the project? Yeah.
And Public Image were, and Throbbing Grizzle, we were all excited. Throbbing Grizzle were coming, they didn't turn up because of snow or something. But it was amazing gig. And by today's standards, health and safety is pretty much like the squat scene and the whole free festival scene, which came out of the whole squat scene in London. I mean, now everything, you need health and safety and certs, and you know, it's just like the project, when the band finished playing, they showed Monty Python film and then everyone fell asleep on the floor and then got up and started playing, you know. It's I miss that kind of.
So were the, Suzanne, you probably weren't, but were the other, were the rest of you at the Dark Space?
Yeah,
Des played with the Letters Players,
did they? Gosh, did they?
actually.
They might have. John
sure.
Peel came
yeah.
down
John
for
Peel
it.
John Peel was there, yeah.
Yeah, no, I actually met Des the day of The Dark Space. We met in McDonald's romantically, enough. And he slagged something I was wearing, I can't remember. But yeah, but I think they did play, actually, yeah. That was amazing. Yeah, it was just, it was great for, like, I think I met more people, that and the Clash gig, obviously. And,
I think that's when I handcuffed myself to a cop.
Yeah, I remember that.
Well,
anything was possible. The Dark Space was 24 hours, or was it 48 hours of just non-stop playing and events and music, and you, again, didn't know what was happening. You went from room to room, and you could be, like, could be Johnny Lydon in one room, and it could have been, you know...
trying to do a sound check at 3 a.m. in another room, and everyone starts coming in.
People slept on the floor. The food came in from somewhere, people just got food. But it was just non-stop, and then sometimes bands would play again, even though they weren't supposed to. It was a scene, and it was probably, there's never been anything like it since, as far as
Sheridan
I know.
Sheridan Brothers, they just moved from, the project was up in South King Street, and they just moved down to East Essex Street, and had loads of volunteers in digging out the floor, because that was a lot of people coming together to create the Project Art Centre as well, because they, digging out the floor and then laying on the concrete, and I think it's one of the first things they did, wasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, for anyone who wasn't there, and I certainly wasn't, but you know, I've read about, I've obsessed about it ever since. It was the theatre crowd who thought, hey, wouldn't it be great to give young people an opportunity to do their thing? They tried to get Public Image Limited, it would have been one of their first gigs, but Lydon cancelled at the last minute. I think only one of the English bands, it might have been the Mekons, made it over. You know, because bands were travelling on the car ferry. But it was also a really important moment, and we'll have to wrap this up, unfortunately, on this moment.
Nigel Rolfe.
Yeah, Nigel Rolfe, your performance artist who influenced people like the Virgin Prunes and Stano. But it was a meeting of the tribes with the bands from the north coming down.
Yeah, I was going to say that. Like, and people
in Dublin
going,
you know,
They weren't going to let me in, and I arrived at the door, and they said, "Oh no, you're not coming in." And it took all these Northern Irish punks to come over and have a word with the security, saying, "She's in the band, you have to let her in," you know. And it was like, reluctantly, they let me in. I was extremely well behaved.
And the Northern bands, you know, do you have any memories of them? Because you know, they came, they lived in a different situation. They came down here. They were very well supported down here. Although they did get grief sometimes, you know, trouble with the rumps at anything. But do you have any memories of the Northern bands coming over and coming down? And
so many great bands from the North, just brilliant. And the scene up there was great. And Terry,
Terry Hooley, yeah. I mean, Good Vibrations. And when those records, like Advance Records was the channel that I used to find, you know, punk records and new wave records and reggae records and R&B Records, as it was called then. And Advance, when the Dandelion disappeared, when Advance disappeared, it had become a bit more mainstream, and you could get things, and so bands came in. So the Northern bands, there weren't so much Northern bands anymore. They were really, when the Outcasts came the first time, they were really special. When the Undertones played here, they were really, the energy was phenomenal, and their sound was different. I don't know why it sounded different, but it was like a Northern, the guitars had a Northern accent, whereas, you know, the Dublin sound was a particular thing. And I can remember, say, Five Go Down from the Sea later on had a different sound as well. So the thing evolved, but it was a distinctive feeling. And I think that was one of the reasons we liked being in bands, being in music. It was a way to communicate with everybody, audiences and other bands. And it was very supportive.
That's and it was interesting that, like, a lot of the gay bars, like Bartley Gardens,
was
a refuge. Like, when you're getting run off the street, you're going to get punched in the head for looking different. You run to Bartley Dunn's, and also in Northern Ireland, the Heart Bar.
Yeah.
That was a gay venue as well. Yeah. So it was interesting that people sort of were more embracing of the punk rock.
That was also probably true in London as well, actually, you know, in the 77 when I was there.
The only thing I can say about that whole thing was like, it was like being in love for years. It was the music that did it. I can't remember anything ever being as vivid as that. And I remember when the scene kind of wound down, the bands that made it went away, And then the other bands kind of stayed around, or else they broke up inevitably after a while and they came back together again. But there was a time when it all ended. I remember actually being on O'Connell Bridge when the Sex Pistols finished and picking up the paper. And they finally made the headline that all the newspapers wanted, you know. They broke, but then they realised there wouldn't be any more stories about them, because for a year they were everywhere. And so it became, so that was the end for me of that kind of era in Dublin. It became something else after that. But the energy and the colours and the people were fantastic. And there's still a lot of people in this room, I hope, who remember that time. But the thing that's changed for me is like the going out, the finding the gigs, the finding the new voices. It's harder to find that now. So you better make that album.
It's out there, I promise it's out there. Come together, the excuses, the
there's lots of little secret little venues and little clubs and illegal.
Yeah.
Well, I got into the whole skateboarding scene, which was a very sort of like my transition. Then was like I left Ireland and had a skateboard company for a long time, and that was very kind of punk rock too and music. But yeah, it was a great time, and it's great. And we're still here. Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it?
Great. And on that positive note, thank you so much, for an amazing panel.
Woo!